Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Wednesday, April 8th, 2020. I'm Buster Olney, working from my home studio in New York. Taylor Schwenk is working from his home studio in Connecticut. And Taylor, today is a big day in baseball history. 46th anniversary of one of the biggest events in baseball history. I know you're not as big of a baseball nerd as I am, but off the top of your head, what do you think? Do you remember what it was?
46 years ago. That's
a hell of a hint.
So I'm 30. So we're talking 1973. I have no idea. 74. I have no idea, Buster. Literally zero clue.
Okay. Well, listen to this.
One ball and no strikes. Aaron waiting. The outfield deep and straight away. Fastball is a high drive into deep left center field. Buckner goes back to the fence. It is gone. What a marvelous moment for baseball. What a marvelous moment for Atlanta and the state of Georgia. What a marvelous moment for the country and the world. A black man is getting a standing ovation in the Deep South for breaking a record of an all-time baseball idol. And it is a great moment for all of us, and particularly for Henry Aaron.
Yep, that's right. It's the anniversary of the day when Hank Aaron broke Babe Ruth's all-time home run record, April 8th, 1974. It happened in Atlanta. And Taylor, I was 10 years old, and you know, I told you I grew up on a dairy farm. So I'd get up early, you know, 4:35 o'clock to go to the barn every day. And so I fell asleep before that took place. But my mom, my wonderful late mom, who really was the one who got me interested in baseball because she bought me a book on Sandy Koufax when I was 8 years old. She left me a note on the kitchen table the morning after. And she described it, how what happened, that Hank Aaron had broke Babe Ruth's record. And she just had one sentence, and it said, "The crowd cheered." And I always think of finding that note the morning after and being so excited about what Hank Aaron did.
That's so funny that as soon as you said like you fell asleep and that you started saying your mom, and my first thought was what my parents would do is pop in a videotape and record something on TV, and that just simply wasn't an option back in the day.
No, and we didn't even have a television. She listened to we had nothing but radio until I finally overpowered my parents when I was 15 and got to watch some the World Series on television.
Wow, different times.
All right. Speaking of legends, today we're going to be talking with former Giants manager Bruce Bochy, future Hall of Famer. He's got tons of stories and a strong feeling about whether he wants to manage again, and stories about Pete Rose, Tony Gwynn, Buster Posey, Tim Lincecum, Madison Bumgarner. Paul Hembekides will join us because he's got stuff on Bruce Bochy. In the aftermath of reports that Major League Baseball and the Players Association have been discussing a plan to begin to play in Arizona in May, Major League Baseball issued a statement which went along these lines. MLB has been actively considering numerous contingency plans that would allow play to commence once the public health situation is improved to the point that it is safe to do so. While we have discussed the idea of staging games at one location as one potential option, we've not settled on that option or developed a detailed plan. While we continue to interact on a regular basis with governmental and public health officials, we've not sought or received approval of any plan from federal, state, or local officials or the Players Association. Before we get to Boch and Hembo, and I'm going to talk to Hembo about the quote-unquote Arizona plan, check out the latest episode of the Bill Barnwell Show. Barnwell is joined first by Todd McShay as the two discuss the process of scouting quarterbacks. Then Bill Connolly joins Barnwell to break down Joe Burrow's rise from transfer quarterback to the likely first overall pick. Find it wherever you get your podcast.
Jumping into the numbers.
After evaluating millions of pieces of data in the blink of an eye, the winner is Cincinnati by 200 points. Why, you worthless hunk of junk.
This is Hembo Knows.
And Hembo is Paul Hembekides, a researcher at ESPN. He is a honcho on the show Get Up. He tells us he's the head honcho. We've not been able to confirm that. Hembo, I can tell you there were a lot of theories around baseball yesterday that that story about the potential games being played in Arizona in very specific sites, having a biodome type situation with 1,500 members of teams basically locked down to play a bunch of games. There were a lot of theories around the sport yesterday that that was a trial balloon, and I think it fell flat. What'd you think?
I get the same sense, not dissimilar to the trial balloon they floated just a few weeks ago prior regarding the sort of new playoff format in some sense. But to stick to the point here, Buster, I would say when I read the headline, like MLB plans for May start in Arizona, I guess my first sort of cynical reaction was, are they also going to announce that they're releasing a vaccine? Because like short of that, I don't know how on earth that could happen. Then I read the piece, and after reading the piece, I think the way I would best describe their plan is way overly ambitious. I think that's how I would describe it. To be clear, I like the thinking. I like the fact that they're willing to think creatively and outside the box and radically and differently because these are unprecedented times, and we know that. But when you sort of boil all the variables together, it seems extraordinarily unlikely to me that they could pull anything close to this together. So, Buster, I was supposed to be a fourth generation pharmacist, okay, until I got a D in chemistry. I talked to my dad yesterday about this. He's a scientist at AstraZeneca. He was floored by the plan. He described it to me as irresponsible. He thinks it is unfathomable to think that people could be playing baseball as early as next month. His best guess is late in the summer, which is, I think, more in line to what, you know, the rest of us are hearing. And to put it as, I guess, clearly as I could in chatting with him and reading some other science on the matter, what would have to happen essentially is everyone would need to be tested in order to get this approved. Like everybody, 1,500 people, like you said, which would be close to impossible given the current testing climate. And then those people would then have to not be exposed to anything. And to be able to control the behavior of 1,500 human beings over the course of 4.5 months, Buster, I think is next to impossible.
Oh, I would agree with you. You know, I wrote a column on Sunday about how I understand this sort of reflexive push for sports leagues to get back. And we saw after 9/11 how it came back, and it was so healing for New York and for folks around the country to have the distraction of baseball and other sports, which is something that the White House really wanted. And the White House, you know, right now, you probably want that, but there's one enormous difference between the situation after 9/11, the situation now. You made reference to it. You can't tell the players that you can keep them safe. You can't tell Correct. The players, you know, that you're going to protect them. And I tweeted out over the weekend that if I were a player, my first question would be about this biodome idea. Are the owners going to be in there too? Are all these owners going to be in with us and taking the same risks? And short of that, I wouldn't entertain it.
And I would also say this, Buster, quickly. There are two things that weren't mentioned in that piece that I think like, – these are the first two things I texted Jeff after I read it. One, what about the minor leaguers, right? They weren't made mention of once. Are we just going to – are the careers and the seasons at the very least of all these minor leaguers just a wash? And secondly, Major League Baseball would have to make spitting – punishable by fine. Like this, that is one of the ways in which it is most easily transmitted. Imagine watching a baseball game without spitting. Like no. that's another sort of caveat to this that I thought was interesting and probably worth bringing up when we finally end up having this conversation in more detail.
All right. Give me some reflections on Al Kaline, the Hall of Famer, but more than that. And you saw the reaction after he passed away to what a great person he was.
Yeah, Buster. Al Kaline was one of the good guys. He was my grandfather's favorite player. My grandfather rooted for the Detroit Tigers. He grew up in Northwest Ohio, and so I got to hear lots of stories about Al Kaline. And revered is probably the best way to put it. Like he's of a rare breed. One of very few people who's as synonymous with the city for whom he played as anyone in any sport. And it was so refreshing to see the outpouring of love for him. I read an extraordinary obit in the Detroit Free Press with enormous detail. And as you know, we talked about Al Kaline as a player just last week because Jim Kotz spoke so highly of him as a player on your podcast itself. But there's a few things that really stuck out to me about Al Kaline, Buster, as a player. First of all, was we obviously remember him as being prodigious. To sign a big league contract the day after you graduate high school and then appear a week later in a game is a pretty extraordinary thing. He remains to this day the youngest player to ever win a batting title. And I think the best story that I read that really speaks to who he was as a person was in 1968, he missed, as you recall, a lot of time with an injury, and the Tigers wound up in the World Series that year. And he volunteer to take himself out of the lineup despite being their best player. And instead, they played him. He hit nearly 400 in the World Series and was as big a reason why they won as anybody. But that's the kind of person he was. He was unselfish to a fault almost. He never won an MVP. He's a person who I think he was very much overlooked in some sense in the scope of that time period in baseball, because the American League then was dominated by the Yankees. But a tremendous person, a great player, and it was nice to sort of have his moment in the sun one more time this week. It was sad, but it was refreshing.
Yeah, it was one of those reactions that was absolutely universal, that people really liked him and respected him for the type of person that he was. All right, we're going to be hearing from Bruce Bochy in a second. What was your biggest takeaway from the interview, which we sent to you? You got a sneak preview of it, and he was talking about Tony Gwynn.
His Tony Gwynn stuff was extraordinary, and I have to admit that I didn't ever study Tony Gwynn's career in the sense where I sort of broke it down sort of before and after he embraced hitting for power. But Buster, I was overwhelmed at the numbers that I saw, and you'll hear Bruce Bochy in the interview talk about this. So in the final eight seasons of Tony Gwynn's career, that's ages 34 through 41, he posted a .500 slugging percentage. That's the exact same slugging percentage as Fred McGriff did during that time, just for some context. It was a number 14% higher than it was early in his career, when theoretically he would have been hitting for more power. And to provide a little bit more perspective on what that is at a player of that age or older, 34 or older, it's a higher slugging percentage than Ken Griffey Jr., Mel Ott, Reggie Jackson, or Willie McCovey posted in those seasons. And as you'll hear Bruce Bochy say, he did it without sacrificing power, Buster. During that time, Tony Gwynn batted .356. Only Ty Cobb hit for a higher batting average than Tony Gwynn after the age of 33. As you said, he got better with age when he truly embraced hitting for a little bit more power and spinning on the baseball. And I'm gonna bring this up, and I didn't tell you this was coming. There's one swing that I vividly remember illustrating this point, Buster. It was game one of the 1998 World Series. David Wells threw a fastball on his fist, and Tony Gwynn spun it around and hit it off the third deck, and it was a rocket. It felt like it hit the third deck in like 3 seconds. That is a swing, I think, that best illustrates the hitter that Tony Gwynn became. And obviously, as you'll hear, that it was Ted Williams, in some sense, that inspired him to do it.
Yeah, Boach tells that story about being in the same room with Tony Gwynn and Ted Williams. My goodness, I can't imagine how much if you put that up for a charity auction, heaven someplace, how much money would that generate? Wow.
That's really cool.
All right, so what are your favorite numbers on Bruce Bochy?
So the thing I like most about Bochy, especially in listening to the interview, is his temperament. And I truly believe that his temperament had a real effect on those Giants teams that won 3 World Series in 5 years. Bruce Bochy went 5-0 in his managing career in postseason winner-take-all games, and his team, Buster, outscored their opponent 29-6 in those games. Wow. He also went 10-1 with the Giants when facing elimination. And one other portion of this, I think, truly is how he managed his bullpens, and I do believe that his personality played in performance in a tangible way. And the Giants' 3 World Series winning seasons, 10, 12, and 14, his bullpen posted a 2.42 ERA in those 3 postseasons. Opponents batted .154 with a .515 OPS in high leverage circumstances. Like, it is extremely clear to me, and listening to him talk and then watching how his teams performed, that he truly had an effect on the temperament of his roster. And the last thing that I'll say is this: I loved hearing him talk about Madison Bumgarner, and it sort of reminded me of the way that we now view John McGraw and Christy Mathewson, two legends of the game. Now, obviously, Bochy and Bumgarner aren't avatars for those two. You know, McGraw was a gruff person, and as we know, Christy Mathewson was, you know, they called him the Christian gentleman, one of the most beloved figures in baseball history still. But the way in which they trusted each other, the manner in which they speak of each other, the postseason success that they had together is not any different than what we saw with Tom Brady and Bill Belichick, for example. I think in 100 years from now, we'll look back on the combination of Bruce Bochy and Madison Bumgarner very similarly.
And at some point, we got to hear the bear hunting story.
Oh,
we got to hear the bear hunting. I got to break Boach down on that. All right, Hembo, thanks for doing this.
Later, boys.
Bruce Bochy managed 25 years in the big leagues. He wound up with 2,003 career wins before he ended his tenure with the San Francisco Giants. Boach, how you doing?
Buster, I'm doing well. It's good to talk with you here as we go through these tough times. How's things with you?
I'm hanging in there, yeah, and I appreciate you joining us for some storytelling. Before we get to that, this is your first spring away from baseball, and God knows how many years you were a teenager, right?
Buster, I mean, I have to go back to 1975. You know, that was the year I was drafted. I didn't know, you know, that was after spring training, but that was the, you know, last time I did not go to spring training. And, you know, I didn't know how I would feel, but I did go into camp with the Giants, and I was good with it. But you know what kept me busy, too, was I agreed to manage the French team in the WBC in this qualifying round that they had in Tucson. And my son was going to pitch for me. My brother, Joe, he was my bench coach. And we had a blast with it. We worked out there in Tucson, and we were getting ready to start the round, the qualifying round against Germany. And, of course, it was called off because of this coronavirus. And I felt for those players, those French players. I mean, they were so looking forward to it. And, you know, it was a lot of money for them. I mean, it was $1,000 for each player just to play in it, but they won it. Or if they qualified, I mean, they would get 4,000. And these are guys that have jobs back in France. And you know, we got a group together, and I just like the way we came together. We played a couple of giant teams, I'm talking about minor league teams, to get ready. We won one, lost one. So they were really pumped up. So very disappointed about it getting called.
Did that whet your appetite, Boach, to at some point go back to managing?
You know, I'm not going to lie. It was good to be back on the field. It really was, you know, working with these guys. You know, it was a lot of fun to see these guys just playing for the love of the game. You know, it's not like they were getting paid a lot. They just had a real passion and a great spirit, you know, for the game. And so it was, you know, that really made it so much better for me. But, you know, personally, no, I'm not going to lie. It was good to be on the field. And I don't know what, you know, I'll end up doing, but right, you know, it doesn't matter right now. We're all doing the same thing.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And no one knows, you know, when we're going to start up again. I mentioned to you in the text I sent you, I wanted to pick your brain on some memories and some for some storytelling. And I want to start with this. And I, you know, I'd forgotten about this and I've never actually asked you about it. September 11th, 1985, in Cincinnati. Today, Pete Rose set the all-time hit record, and you were the catcher. What do you remember about that?
Right, right. And, you know, I became the catcher every day there for, I think, a couple weeks, only because Terry Kennedy, who was a starting catcher, his back went out on him. And so yeah, we're going to Cincinnati, and I'm excited that I'm catching and, you know, have this chance to be back behind the plate when, you know, if Pete Rose gets a record. And, you know, I just remember, you know, the first game, Lamar Hoyt was pitching, and I think Rose went 0-for-4, and we just pounded him inside. And Lamar had that fastball, had good right to it. He could really pitch in well with it, you know, above the hands. And he could cut it too inside there, and you know, Pete at that time, you know, he didn't quite have the same bat speed, so you know, we pounded him in, and he had an 0-for-4. And now Kennedy, meanwhile, is starting to get healthy. I'm getting nervous. I don't want, you know, this being interpreted as I called a pitch he could hit, but Eric Chow is pitching the next day, and you know, we had it might have been a 2-1 count at. I don't remember. I should, but anyway, we threw I called a slider. Eric Schau threw a slider, and that was probably in his bat speed, to be honest. It jammed him. Hit that little flare to right to left field, and Carmelo Martinez couldn't quite get to it. And of course, you had the celebration. I mean, it was unbelievable. You know what happened after that? You know, the city of Cincinnati. How they celebrated, of course, you know, the game stopped and for quite a while. And, of course, you had Eric Chow, who, you know, I don't think down deep he meant to show any disrespect, but he sat on the mound, and, you know, that was controversial. But, you know, it was just Eric. And you knew Eric Chow. He just, you know, was different in ways that, you know, he just didn't realize what he was doing. So, anyway, beside that, it was like Mardi Gras in Cincinnati, that night is what I remember.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned that. The other day we were talking about that because, we were talking about Cal Ripken's 21-31 and how the Angels players, you know, one of the coaches, Joe Maddon, so excited to be part of that moment. You know, Cal going around doing the lap, handshaking everyone. And as you mentioned, 10 years earlier when Eric Schau gave up that hit, he sat on the rubber. And I agree with you. I didn't certainly know him nearly as well as you did, but I don't think he intended to show up. Pete Rose, he just didn't know what to do. And the game was stopped and everyone was just kind of waiting. And no one knew how long that delay would be at the time he set the record.
Right, right. And you know what? I take some responsibility there because I was catching. I should have walked out to the mound. But, you know, I was watching everything because it was an honor to be part of that. And I was one that didn't go up to Pete, actually. I just thought that was a time for his teammates, his family, and I would hopefully catch up with him later and congratulate him. And so, you know, looking back, I wish I'd have gone out to the mound. But here's Eric, just standing there on the mound. And as you said, he didn't know how long this would last. So he was going to take a seat. So instead of going to dugout, he did it right on the rubber there. And unfortunate thing because he really took a lot of heat for that. And but I wish I would have gone out to the mound.
So what do you remember about your conversation with Pete the next time he came to the plate?
You know, he was the one that talked a lot when he came up there. But what he did do, and it was unsolicited, was a picture that was taken of that has me in the picture, about to receive the ball. And Pete signed a dozen of those pictures and had it sent over to the clubhouse to me. That was nice. Here I was a young kid and I grew up a Reds fan, Buster. I was a huge Reds fan, especially, the big Red Machine. I used to, skip school and go watch them over in Tampa. And I was always a big Bench Rose fan, Joe Morgan, Perez, all of them. And so that was a big deal for me. And I've seen Pete a couple times since that, but it's not something we've talked about.
Well, let me ask you, I try to explain to people all the time how within baseball, Pete was so revered for the way he played and the way he went after, attacked the game every day during the course of his career. What do you remember about how other players felt about him? And how do you feel about the question with him in the Hall of Fame?
Pete was, he was just so well liked by everybody, in the game, in the way he played, very popular. He was one that, if he wasn't hitting, he was always talking baseball with somebody. Is how I saw him. A guy that just loved the game and had there's tons of energy it's very popular. Now you're talking about the Hall of Fame. That's going to be, I know personally, I look at guys who were the best players in the game, and there's a lot of them that are not in them. I mean, look, there's a lot of them that's not in the Hall of Fame, and what Pete did, that was considered the rule, the biggest rule at that time, and the Veterans Committee there. I mean, his peers, the guys he played with, they're not voting men, and I respect them for what they want to do. It's how I look at it, and it's not my call. I just believe that if it's going to happen, then it to be voted on by his peers, and right now they don't believe it, so I respect that.
One appearance in the World Series for you, and you got a hit. You got 1,000 batting average in the World Series. What do you remember about that?
Oh, man. The one thing I remember is how bad I wanted to get in there and hopefully get an appearance. It was the final game of that series. And Detroit, they had taken a pretty good lead. Gibson hit the home run off a goose there. And Dick, he wasn't known for being a compassionate man. He was, very, very tough-minded manager that, I saw a different side of him because I was with him all the time. But, in his heart, he found a way to get me in there. And I'll forever appreciate that. And I was nervous as could be as I went up there. And I the first pitch, I kid about this. I hit a foul ball home run buster, and I hit 714 of those, I tell everybody, unfortunately. it was about 15 feet foul, and it was off Willie Hernandez, who won the Cy Young that year. And then I ended up getting a line drive base hit that Alan Trammell dove and tried to catch on the backhand side. And I kidded Alan when I hired him as a coach, you know, you're here because you didn't catch that ball. And I just want you to know that. And so anyway, I get the hit, and I don't get long to enjoy it, though, because, you know, Dick Williams wanted to get somebody else in the game to make an appearance. So Ron Renicky pinch ran for me. And, you know, I think it was a four-run game at that point, and it wasn't like that run was important, but he found a spot there to get Ronnie in, which I was happy for him. And so, you know, it's short-lived as far as my enjoying my time on the field, but, you know, it's a moment I'll never forget.
Did you get the baseball? That was kind of before that became a regular routine of getting the baseballs.
Yeah, no, I didn't get it. I didn't get it. Who knows? Yeah, I don't know. It probably stayed in the game. That's the way it was back then. But I never thought about getting it either. But, you know, it sure would have been nice to have gotten it.
What's a story you got later on when you became manager of the Padres? Of course, the best player on your team at that time was Tony Gwynn. What's a story you like to tell friends about Tony Gwynn?
You know, just beside, you know, his talent, you know, what he meant for me in my first year managing, you know, Tony and I played together, and so we became pretty good friends. We both lived in Poway, and, you know, at one point, fishing was his passion. That's one of mine, and so we had done some bass fishing together, and then we golfed, and so, you know, we were somewhat pretty good friends, played cards, and so now I'm becoming manager. Now it's a little different. He's going to be one of my players. And, but unfortunately, as you know, and we had that strike, in 94, and that carried into 95, which was my first year managing. So my first year managing, I've got replacement players, and, I'm not comfortable doing this. And, you know, Randy Smith, who hired me, he helped me out. He said, listen, if you think one of the coaches should do most of the workouts, you know, let them do it. I get it, because I didn't want to lose credibility, you know, with my players when that strike was over. So, Tim Flannery, he picked me up there, and he ran most of spring training, to be honest. And so when it ended, the strike, and we get the season going again, Tony was the one that, you know, really helped me as far as saying, you know, just telling the players, listen, I know Boach, he knows the game, he knows what he's doing, to help, you know, give me credibility. His locker was right beside my office there at the old Jack Murphy or the Qualcomm. And so, you know, that's what I'll never forget, because I think there were at that time two or three players that, you know, they're kind of cold towards you because you were supposedly working with these replacement players, but, you know, he really picked me up there. But, you know, there were times, though, when we talked about as teammates, you know, that he'd go up and he just knew what pitch he was going to get. And he would tell you in the dugout, you know, he's going to throw me a slider here, and I'm going to do this with it. And he would do it. You know, I'm going to hit that five high ball because, you know, he's going to, you know, keep throwing me away. And it's just incredible what this guy could do with the bat.
And the amazing thing about him, Boach, is that with all the batting titles, you know, that he won, it still felt like in the midst of his career, he got better, because I think based on a conversation he had with Ted Williams, he really learned to look for situations to drive the ball.
Oh, no question. And you're right. It changed him. And, you know, Ted called him out, basically. I still remember, you know, that evening at John Morris's house, he had Ted Williams over, and in fact, Ted, the first time he saw me, he says, I hear you like to fish. And he says, what kind of flies do you tie? I go, Ted, I don't fly fish. You don't fly fish. Well, you don't fish then. I mean, he's just so intimidating. And he was the same way with Tony about hitting. And he got on Tony about, you know, not hitting that inside pitch and doing damage with it, because that's where you make your living, you know. you should be hitting the ball over the 5-5 hole, Tony. You're a great hitter. And, you know, anybody can do that, but, you know, but you can hit the ball out of the park and you, you know, should start looking to drive that pitch. And it changed Tony. And, but it didn't take away his average either. It just, Tony was, he's just one of those players, those great players, as you know, that they just feel like they never have arrived and they want to be better. And that was Tony. He was so driven to be the best hitter he can be. And he worked on that inside pitch to where it became natural. And if they threw it in there, he would turn on it and started hitting home runs and driving the ball and was a better hitter. And I think, you know, he's probably looking back going, you know what? If I would have done that earlier in my career, he probably would have 300 or 400 home runs.
What do you remember about his relationship, Tony's relationship with Barry Bonds, someone who you, at the end of Barry's career, you got to manage? Because it always, those two guys, you know, had such a special relationship. It almost felt like a little bit, you know, the way that you'd hear about Larry Bird and Magic Johnson.
And it was that way, exactly, like that. Those two just had such a tremendous respect for each other, you know, at what they had accomplished in the game, and completely different hitters and completely different philosophy, which amazes me, you know, because as I managed Barry my first year, and Tony was a guy, you know, he really believed in you know, the bottom hand underneath, you know, the knob leading the way. And Barry was, he talked about a top hand, you know, catching the ball. And he took his top hand on the bat. And so it was amazing. I'm looking at two of the best hitters in our era, and they had different philosophies, and, but they were different type of hitters. So they, you know, that played a part in that, but, no, they just always talked hitting, always got together and talked baseball. It was two of the greatest that had that tremendous respect, like, you know, Bird and Magic and guys like that.
Tony always loved to tell the story about how during batting practice one day, Bonds came out while the Padres are taking BP, and Bonds is riding him about his bat, which he referred to, you know, as the pea shooter because it was so small. And he said that Barry grabbed it out of his hands during one round, and then it proceeded to hit about 11 straight balls, as, of course, Barry, a left-handed hitter, into the left field stands in Qualcomm, and just flipped the bat away like he was throwing a toothpick away.
Amazing, amazing guy, what he could do. You know, there were times when, you know, because he knew I had Tony in spring training. He goes, you know, I can do what Tony does. You know, see that 5-5 hole? And he would just hit ball after ball right there in that hole. I remember one time he got on Klesko, because Klesko and BP was, you know, hitting in Triple's Alley there at in San Francisco. And he was complaining about how deep it is there. And Barry goes, well, you're stupid even doing that. Why are you doing that? This is what you want to do. And Barry would take it and just flip it and just hit it over to 309 down the right field line. And so, you know, you're looking at a guy that's all-time home run leader, but you know, also had just incredible bat control and things he could do with it. And in fact, when he tied the record, I still remember he knew Clay Hensley was going to throw the ball away on him, those sinkers away. It was in San Diego, and took BP. In fact, I was throwing BP extra to him that day, and my ball had a little run to it, so that's why he wanted me to throw to him, because it would be similar to Clay's. And sure enough, you know, he said, Clay's going to throw me that sinker away. I'm going to take it out to left field, and he did.
So I wanted, there are a million Madison Bumgarner stories. Tell me your favorite one that you like to tell people about Madison.
Well, my favorite, well, I'm pausing for a second because I can't tell my favorite. It's a bear hunting trip that I swore secrecy on that. And hopefully he'll let me tell it one day. But on the baseball side, my favorite, of course, was 2014. And the incredible run that and that he had personally, you know, between the wild card game and, of course, what he did in Game 7. But it was after Game 5. He had just shut out the Royals. And And I had switched it a little bit because I just felt like we had to go in Kansas City up a game instead of down a game. So, and because I was taking some heat for not pitching them in game four and then start them in game seven. And but I had Bogusson start game four against their fifth starter, and I wanted Baumgartner to pitch against Shields. Anyway, to shorten this up, he shuts out the Royals, and you know, now we're going to Kansas City. We're up 3-2. We're a game away from, you know, being the World Series champions, and guys are, you know, they're starting to pack because we got to go to KC. And he comes to my office. He goes, you know, I just want to tell you, if you want to win this thing, you're going to put me out there. You're going to start me. And I said, start you when? He goes, after his day off. He meant game six. I said, no, I'm not starting you with one day's rest. He goes, I'm telling you, if you want to win this thing. And anyway, we didn't start in game six because we want to save him for game seven. In the pen, you know, he'd be, you know, the guy that we go to as a lone guy. And I said, well, you know, we haven't set the pitch on game seven. Right now it's Hudson. And he and Huddy were very close. They really became not just good teammates, but very good friends. And he looked at me and said, no, you got to start Huddy. I want him to start this game, but you have me ready if you want to win this thing. And, of course, you know what happened there. So it's just a guy that had this maniacal focus on winning that World Series, and he wasn't going to hold back on his feelings.
No, he pitched twice as many innings, more than twice as many innings than any other pitcher in that postseason on any team. And yet, I think he told me at one point that after you guys win game seven, and he is one of the most amazing postseason performances in baseball history, he finally acknowledged to you that he was tired.
Yeah. He owned it. Well, of course, everybody was. I mean, because emotionally, you're tired. Mentally, I mean, it's just, you're talking about every pitch, every play on the line. And of course, with him, you know, it's not like we gave him a concussion. He was pitching with a one-run lead. And, of course, what happened in the ninth inning, you know, with the two-out triple, and he still has to get one more out because I could see it warming up. But I remember when he came in after the seventh and eighth inning, I wasn't going to look at him because I didn't want him to look at me and say, hey, I'm done. Because he, you know, he was our horse then, and he was throwing the ball so well. But yeah, he finally owned up to it. But you know what, Buster, I'll say, to me, it's the greatest, you know, pitching performance ever. Yes. in postseason. Because yeah, you know, it hasn't been that long since, you know, we've had the extra games, a wild card, and extra postseason games, and no one's had pitched as many innings as he did.
Jake Peavy is a great storyteller, and he told me a great story about Baumgartner and you that I've never asked you about, and I want to check it out with you. He said that the reason why you won 2014 the World Series, he said there was a moment in the dugout. You guys are playing the Dodgers late in the season. He's losing to Zach Greinke 2-1, and his spot in the lineup is coming up in the eighth inning. And according to Jake, he said, you know, you basically let him know you're going to pinch hit for him, and he's lobbying. He wants to bat because he loves to hit. He's down a run. It's a big game against the Dodgers. And you're saying, this is according to Jake, you're saying, I know. And then Madison, after hearing that a couple times, goes, you ain't talking to me like you know. And then you let him hit. That's Jake's story. What do you remember about that?
Yeah, it was close. I mean, it was close. You know, Jake, he probably embellished that just a hair, but that's Jake. You know what? It was a situation where he was our best, and I thought he earned that right to hit. But originally, I was not going to let him hit because I want to look after him too. I mean, he had worked hard, you know, but he was one of our biggest threats, and that's what I remember that really. Made up my mind was, you know what, let's go, Bum, because he deserved it, and he was one of our best threats. He was one of our best clutch hitters. I'm telling you, this guy, when you needed, you know, a big hit or even a home run, somehow he came through for you. And in fact, I kid him all the time now because, you know, he's not the hitter he was because he's trying to see how far he can hit it. But at that time, he knew how to sit on the pitch. And so anyway, he was, you know, we were going back at it, back at each other a little bit, but I had made up my mind, hey, he's going to hit. And I told Rags that, and I said, you know what, he's going to hit, but I'm going to have some fun with this.
Tell me your favorite first time you laid eyes on Tinlinscomb, and whether or not was there any part of you as someone who'd been in baseball a long time wondering if that was going to work, that unusual delivery.
Well, Buster, the first time I saw him was 2007, which was my first year in San Francisco, and I still remember spring training. It was a lot different, because I had so many years in San Diego, and the Giants were the team that we had to beat, and it was after the first meeting that you have with your team. And I'm heading out to the field. I'm with Dave Righetti, and Dave goes, Rags goes, hey, by the way, there's your number one pick. And I look over, and it's this, scrawny-looking guy that's getting ready to play catch. And I'm like, you're kidding me. And I just can't imagine, this 150-pounder being a number one pick. And the first ball I still remember he threw was like it was 90 miles an hour. And he just had this whip to him. And so I said, wow, this guy looks like he's got pretty good stuff. And then, of course, he pitched. And it was most, incredible thing as far as a pitcher I'd ever seen was and that's why he got nicknamed the Freak. It's how freakish it was because of his unique delivery. And it was like a whip in his arm, and his arm was, just a whip that just came along for the ride. And I knew then that's what this guy's different. This guy is, he's going to be special. And, sure enough, 40 years was over, here he is pitching for us. And, he's one of the most amazing pitchers I've ever had. And I've had some good ones, but just his style, his way, never iced, never took a lot of time to warm up. And, one thing about Timmy, 2012, his stuff was starting to go down a little bit. I still remember going up to him in the weight room and, I'm walking up to him and says, Timmy, we're going into playoffs. I said, I just think if we can get you to help us out in the bullpen, we have the best chance to win this thing. And he, without hesitating, just looked at me and goes, hey, you think this is, this is the best way to win it? Let's do it. I'm ready for it. And, he hadn't pitched out of the pen. I know I'm getting long-winded here, but the first game he's coming in the pitch, this guy didn't get up. We said, get Timmy up, and he was sitting in the dugout. And I look up. I go, where's Timmy? And Rack says, I told him to start getting ready, but Timmy didn't understand that it was for that inning, not for the next inning.
Wow.
He didn't take long to get up. So he got up and he threw maybe four or five pitches. He said he was good and went out there and just dealt. And he was similar, to Trevor Hoffman. He threw, seven or eight pitches. He was ready to go.
That's amazing for someone who'd been a starter as long as he was. Boach, I've never asked you. You and I have had a lot of conversations, and I think your voice was an important one to make the change with the home plate collision rules with catchers. That, of course, after Buster Posey had his leg shattered with that play at home plate, Scott Cousins barrels into him, and the change came after that year. I've never asked you about what that night was like for you afterward, and having been a catcher yourself and seeing what Buster went through.
Well, I'll preface this. For someone to really get a feel of what that is, getting hit, you need to be back there, and you'll just realize how vulnerable a catcher is. And and when Buster got hit, I just remember jogging out there, man, just praying that this wasn't bad. He just kind of got his bell rung. And but once I got out there and saw the pain he was in, I knew there was damage on this one. And, I thought it was a knee initially and ended up being his ankle. But, it just brought back a memory as I'm standing out there with him. And I'll go back to L.A. when Gary Bennett got hit. He got hit by Brian Jordan, who was a football player. And I thought he killed him. I mean, Bennett was out. He was laying on the ground. And, you know, these players, you get attached to it. I mean, they're like your kids. And I just had this sick feeling in my stomach. And then I'm back out there with Buster. I just said, you know, how much longer are we going to let this happen? I mean, it's going to be a matter of time before we carry somebody off on a stretcher and he's in a wheelchair the rest of his life or something. You know, this is crazy. And you're just not protected. And I know there's some old school guys, you know, not buying into it, but these guys are bigger and faster. And of course, you know, for a while it was a case where that was the target, not scoring, but hitting the catcher. And that was the case with Buster, because he was way in front of home plate. He wasn't blocking the plate. And so that feeling, you know, I just didn't want to have it again. So, you know, I was part of trying to get this rule changed. I know Mike Matheny played a big role in this. And I feel good about it being changed. That, you know, I didn't have to see somebody who had their neck broken or something, because it was going to happen, Buster. It's just a matter of time.
And one final question for you, Boach. I don't think, because now, you know, Buster's had an amazing career. He's got, you know, probably some years ahead of him as we move forward as well. Maybe someday he's going to get an honor in the Hall of Fame and be out on the back porch, the Otis saga with you. But I think that people don't realize that there was a time there after that injury where there was some real question about whether or not his career was going to be in jeopardy.
Oh, there was. I thought, you know, this is probably a 50-50 deal whether he would be able to catch again. This is how bad this injury, how devastating this injury was. And Dave Greshner, our trainer, he's still our trainer with the Giants, just did an incredible job on his rehab. And, I mean, it took a long time. And the next year, you know, we had to watch him early and take care of him. But, you know, for him to bounce back the way he did and not just bounce back, but play the, you know, the type of baseball that he did and help us win a couple more World Series says about a lot about him, his drive and his work ethic to get himself back to the player that he was. And, you know, when you experience the loss of, you know, your best player, Buster was. I'll go back to pitching. Trevor Hoffman, I had 1 year in San Diego where he was out for the year. You see what life is like, and it was tough not having, you know, Buster running that staff and being on that club. And, you know, nobody impacted our team more than Buster. And so it's really incredible, I think, how long he's played. And the fact that that doesn't bother him as much. Occasionally it will. For example, in Arizona, you know, sometimes that dirt around home plate, it's packed. It's really hard where the sun bakes it. And that will aggravate it a little bit, but he's doing well with it.
Boach, I appreciate your time. I always love talking with you, and I always love bragging about how you were such a great shooter, especially 12 to 15 feet when we played in a rec league together.
Yeah, you got me a little pumped here. I got the hoop right outside. I'm going to go shoot a little bit now. I got to get some exercise anyway.
Here's Tim Kirchens, Daily Baseball Fix, and it's built around someone we were talking about earlier in the podcast.
On this date in 1974, Hank Aaron hit home run number 715. Before the game, Braves relievers all chose locations in the bullpen that they wanted to stand in hopes they would catch historic home run number 715. It was based on seniority. Tom House was a very young reliever, so he ended up way out in left center field. But as soon as Hank hit it, Tom House said, "Oh my goodness, this is going to hit me right in the chest." He said, "I didn't even have to move." After he caught it, he ran the ball into home plate and presented it to Hank, who was in tears. Tom House told me, "I'd never seen Hank Aaron cry before. All the pressure was off. All the stress was off. It took a really strong man to hit more home runs than Babe Ruth."
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for Wednesday, Justin Simmons at Justin Lance Sim 1 writes in, your interview with Biggio the other day got me thinking, what have been the most significant position changes in baseball history other than Babe Ruth moving from pitcher to everyday outfielder?
Well, I'm kind of cheating, and there are definitely a lot that have taken place. Dale Murphy, I think, moving from catcher to the outfield, that helped him. Another one that I thought of was Rick Ankiel, in more recent time, developing the yips as a pitcher and becoming a good major league outfielder, an excellent defensive outfielder. I say go back, and Taylor, I don't think you're going to remember this guy, but Smokey Joe Wood, have you ever heard the name?
Nope, not at all.
Okay, he was an excellent pitcher like a century ago, and then he wound up being a pretty good outfielder as well, right in the same era where Babe Ruth played. So, those are names off the top of my head with that one. Smokey Joe Wood, what a great name.
Incredible name. And Rick Ankiel, obviously my baseball knowledge has been completely exposed in this podcast, but his position change is like one of the, when I was growing up, like an incredible sports story that I remember, talking to my friends when we were young, just like how crazy it was that he would do that and he would be successful at the same time. So definitely a notable name there. Brian Simpson, he's got two questions for us at BSimp1202 74. His first one, he writes in, rewatching the 91 World Series with my 8 and 6 year old sons. They have a question for you. Do you think Lonnie Smith's base running cost the Braves the World Series when he didn't score from first on the double by Terry Pendleton?
I'm not ready to say it cost them the World Series, but it was definitely a pivotal moment in that World Series. I don't know if you've seen video of that, Taylor, but he messed up. He misread the play, and he could have scored on that play. He didn't, and it would turn out to be potentially decisive in terms of the Braves not getting a run they needed.
Second one from Brian. He writes in, I didn't know Al Kaline's nickname was Mr. Tiger. Very similar to our guy, Tony Gwynn, as Mr. Padre. Are there any other players that sum up their franchise or their city in quite this way?
I was trying to think of people who actually got that nickname, Mr. So-and-so from their team, and I couldn't think of another one. But here's some guys, and I'm curious to hear from fans about whether or not they feel like that these would be appropriate candidates. Mr. Mariner, Edgar Martinez. No question. Mr. Philly, I actually would go with Larry Boa because he's been around that franchise as a player, as a manager, as a coach for so long, and he really embodies the spirit of that team. Mr. Cardinal, Red Shandines, he was around that team for a long time as a player, manager, coach. Mr. Red Sox, I'd go with Johnny Pesky, who was someone who had decades and decades and decades with that team. And Mr. Diamondback, Louis Gonzalez, who got that the walk-off hit in Game 7 of the 2001 World Series and continues to work with the Diamondbacks. And, in fact, I expect at some point we're going to get an opportunity to talk with Louis about his memories from that 2001 World Series.
Very good. That is it for Bleacher Tweets for today. Hashtag Bleacher Tweets on Twitter. And please subscribe, rate, and review to this podcast wherever you enjoy your podcasts.
My thanks today to Bruce Bochy, to Hembo, to Taylor Schwenk. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening. And stay safe.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.